This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. There's been a lot of research lately suggesting that most Americans have a pretty poor understanding of basic U.S. civics, how our government and elections work, and what our rights and responsibilities are as citizens. And so earlier this fall, a new project kicked off in the Granite State to address that shortfall, at least in New Hampshire. It's called Constitutionally Speaking, and the goal, organizers say, is a spirited yet civil dialogue about the nation's founding document. And so in that spirit, and on Election Day, we started to wonder what the U.S. Constitution says about voting, and just as important, what it doesn't say. It turns out there's some debate as to whether the Constitution spells out a right to vote. Also, while it seems the founders left the mechanics of voting to the states, there's disagreement on how extensive that control is and whether the federal government should be more involved. Today in The Exchange, Constitutionally Speaking about voting. Let's hear from you. Do you see voting as a guaranteed right, or is it a privilege? Where in the Constitution do you see that spelled out? What discrepancies do you see in our founding document about voting and elections, whether it's who can vote, the issue of electors, and the mechanics surrounding elections? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. Our guests are Calvin Massey, Daniel Webster Distinguished Professor who teaches constitutional law at the UNH School of Law. UNH Law is, by the way, a partner in the Constitutionally Speaking Project. And Calvin Massey, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And joining us by phone is Carol Nakanoff, Richter Professor of Political Science, who teaches American Elections and Constitutional Law at Swarthmore College. Carol will be participating in the Constitutionally Speaking Symposium coming up on November 17th. And Carol, thank you for your time as well. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we on The Exchange were going through the Constitution before the show, trying to see what we could pull out of it in terms of voting. And there's a lot of language there, Calvin, that's pretty hard to understand. Our heads were kind of spinning after we read some of this stuff. Is that just how people talk back then, or did the founders make the wording about voting deliberately difficult?
Well, they operated under an assumption that the states would control voting, and that's why they said relatively little about it in the Constitution that came out of Philadelphia in September of 1787. Each of the states had their own state constitutions, and they relied upon those state constitutions to provide whatever guarantees those states thought were necessary to secure the right to vote. But the operative principle was to leave it up to the states to determine who could vote, what the criteria for voting might be, and even how elections were to be conducted.
So it's deliberately vague, is that what you're saying?
Well, it wasn't so much deliberately vague as a deliberate choice to leave the fundamental issue of voting to the states. Now, that's changed over time. There have been a series of amendments and constitutional rulings that have altered that terrain quite a bit. But the original idea was that the states would have almost plenary control over voting.
You know, Carol, to you, it does seem in some areas now, just talking about the original Constitution first, not all the amendments that came later, in that original Constitution, Carol, it seems like the founders at some points are very picky, very specific. And other times, you know, they leave these loopholes so large a truck could drive through them.
Well, some things are very specific. For example, no person shall be a representative who shall not have attained the age of 25 years and been 7 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state in which he shall be chosen. And then a similar kind of provision with regard to senators, 30 years, 9 years a citizen, et cetera. So those provisions are pretty specific. But it's true, as Calvin said, that states had a variety of rules about qualifications for the franchise, and the Constitution did not disturb those rules except to stipulate some additional rules for election for federal officials.
federal officials, meaning who were very few and far between at that point, right?
That's
You're only talking a couple.
Senators and congressmen that, as I just read you, those particular provisions. There's been an interesting debate about whether those provisions can be added to. The question of term limits, for example, raised the question about whether a state could limit the number of terms that a federal elected official could serve. And the court narrowly said in 1995, no, that the states cannot add such qualifications. They saw it as an addition to what was provided in the Constitution for representatives and senators.
So again, and we will definitely move into all the amendments and laws that have changed these original ideas surrounding voting. But just sticking with the original for just a moment, so what do you think, Calvin? Does this original U.S. Constitution, meaning the one drawn up by the founders, include a right to vote along with all those other rights that it spells out pretty clearly, free speech, freedom of assembly, and so forth?
Well, it doesn't include a federally guaranteed right to vote. It presumes that there will be a right to vote, but it will be conditioned upon what the states chose to do with respect to granting the franchise. So if you look at the 1787 Constitution, I think you'd be hard-pressed to say it that there's any federally guaranteed right to vote. But I think there was a presumption that the states would provide the vote, and that it was under their control as to whom they'd make it available to. So, you know, no democracy could work, and certainly not our democracy could work, without voting. So it was an assumption that there would be voting. But the question of who could vote and how elections would be conducted was also deliberately made by the founders to leave that to the states to determine how they wish to conduct those elections, with one caveat in the original Constitution, and that is that Congress has the power to regulate the time, place, and manner of elections for representatives and senators. Of course, senators didn't matter originally because senators were elected by state legislatures, but after the 17th Amendment, Congress would have authority to control the time, place, and manner of elections for senators as well as federal representatives.
There's a lot of press on this year. And Carol, I wanted to ask you too. I've got, you know, 5, 6, 7 articles in front of me, and most of them have headlines that say this: contrary to popular belief, there is no right to vote in the U.S. Constitution. That's pretty shocking, but a lot of folks are saying that. What do you think, Carol?
Well, I think that's basically true. In Bush v. Gore, the court says there is no individual constitutional right to vote for president unless and until states decide to allow people to elect electors. So in the original Constitution, popular election of electors was not required. Most states by 1830s did allow for popular election of electors, as well as winner-take-all provisions for the allocation of those electors. The last state to allow for popular election of electors was South Carolina after the Civil War. But the Constitution envisions a system in which each state will determine the qualifications for electors for the House of Representatives and the Senate.
It's pretty shocking, though, Carol. I mean, don't you think most Americans assume that the U.S. Constitution gives them the right to vote?
They do assume that, and this notion of universal suffrage, which we believe is the case, can't be read back into the Constitution of 1787. There was no notion of universal suffrage. There were all sorts of qualifications, including in some states, property qualifications. Some states allowed women to vote until about 1819. Most states didn't. In a few states, African Americans who were free were able to vote. a few states even had some religious qualifications for voting. So this was considered to be a state's matter, and there was no concept of universal suffrage at the time.
One more question on this, and then I want to invite our listeners to join us. Calvin, one analyst looking at this in Harper's Magazine said, it's like a contractor in the course of constructing a house ordered the windows, curtains, and shingles, but completely forgot about the foundation.
Well, I think that's a little unfair. I think the assumption is that there was a foundation that was already in place, and that was the actions of the states, colonies before they became states, all of which had taken various measures to provide for voting. So there, it's if you want to use that analogy, it's more like the contractor starting with a foundation. It's not one that he's built. It's one that's in place.
Built by 13 other
right,
colonies or states.
Built by the colonies and then the states. And now we're just constructing a house on top of that. So that's really, I think, the better analogy.
Our phone number here in the Exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, we're looking at what the Constitution says and doesn't say about voting. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Do you see voting as a constitutionally guaranteed right, or is it more of a privilege? What discrepancies do you see in this founding document of ours about voting and elections, whether it's who can vote, how electors are chosen, and the mechanics surrounding the ballot box? Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. And one more question to you, Calvin. And Carol, I want to hear from you, too. Calvin, so you've been saying it was assumed that the states would do this, so the foundation is there. How good a job did the states do, though, back in those early days and moving forward? I mean, some people feel like the states have maybe weren't the best people to give this cherished right to.
Well, if you judge them by the standards of today, we would say that the states didn't do a very good job because the franchise was extremely limited. But if you judge them by the circumstances of their times, voting was far more liberal than it would be in any other part of the world. The United States was one of the few places in the early 19th century where citizens could actually vote and have a voice in the choice of their representatives who govern them. So in that sense, we were an extraordinarily liberal country. From the standpoint of the 21st century, we'd look at that and we'd be shocked to say it's be limited to white males and the like. But that's not fair to judge them by the standards of the 21st century.
And Carol, I'll get your historical perspective on that too after a very short break. We'll take your calls too at 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and more on Constitutionally Speaking about voting on the Exchange on NHPR, and at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, the role of religion in politics. New Hampshire weather today, sunny, chilly, highs around 35 in the north, 40 to 45 for the south. Tonight, clear to partly cloudy and cold, lows from near 15 in the north and 25 in the south. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from the Hannah Grimes Business Incubator in Keene, helping entrepreneurs succeed with combined office space, learning, and networking opportunities. HannahGrimes.com. From Soloway & Hollis, providing legal solutions and effective advocacy for healthcare organizations and professionals, schools, and businesses throughout New Hampshire. And from the New Hampshire Union Leader and NewHampshire.com, opening up the stories, events, and resources essential to living in the Granite State. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what our Constitution says about voting and what it doesn't say. Also, how our voting rights have changed over time. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange at nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. With me in studio, Calvin Massey. He teaches constitutional law at the UNH School of Law. And on the phone, Carol Nakanoff. She's a professor of political science who teaches American elections and constitutional law at Swarthmore College. And Carol, before we go to our listeners, I'd love your thoughts, too, on how limited this right to vote initially was, an implied right, as Calvin has been saying and you've been saying, and how that expanded. Remind us of how long that took to expand it to its full flowering that we see today.
Sure. Well, in the by 1830s or so, virtually all states, Rhode Island was a little late, dropped property qualifications for voting. In debates in state legislatures, people would say things like, well, if we thought there was ever going to be an industrial working class in the United States, we might be less inclined to do this, but we don't see these extremes of wealth and poverty, and we don't think we're going to have this vicious working class. So in the 30s and by 1840, we basically have a white male suffrage without regard to taxpayer or property qualifications. Obviously, we had a moment in the aftermath of the Civil War during Reconstruction when African Americans were enfranchised and elected first, the first African Americans to Congress. By the 1890s, there were all sorts of new restrictions put in place there. So
literacy
it's not a
tests,
linear progress.
Poll taxes like that, Carol?
Sure, poll taxes, grandfather clauses, and literacy tests. But it wasn't just in the South, because in the North there was a reaction against immigration and sort of poorly educated, non-English speaking immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe started upsetting Northerners, and they started passing literacy tests and restrictions on voting as well. It just couldn't be explicitly on the basis of race that restrictions were made. Women's suffrage, of course, in 1920, women finally were allowed to vote for president. Then we get this expansion to 18-year-olds and so on. So the one thing that is important to note is that felony disenfranchisement it still exists, and states are considered having the right to make those decisions, partly because of a reading of the 14th Amendment, where Section 2 basically allows states to withhold suffrage for those who participated in rebellion or other crime. And so many states still disenfranchise felons during the term of their incarceration, but for some states, even during probation, and some states for life.
So if I committed a felony when I was, you know, 20, and now let's say I'm 60, depending on where I live, I still can't vote, Carol?
Correct. That's correct.
Wow. Calvin, you want to jump in there?
That's true. There's a case called Richardson against Ramirez that explicitly upheld felon disenfranchisement. So there's nothing unconstitutional about a state doing that. States are free, of course, to decide that they wish to permit convicted felons to vote if they should so choose. That's the one of the virtues of state control over these matters. States can make their own decisions. If they think felons should be permitted to vote, they're free to do that. But they're not constitutionally compelled to do so.
I think there was a movement in New Hampshire to, correct me if I'm wrong, to look at the idea of having 16-year-olds vote, Calvin. And New Hampshire could do that under the U.S. Constitution.
It could. That's a idea that's been floated around in various states. There's a state senator in California who for some years has been suggesting that the voting age in California should be lowered to 14.
Wow.
Which I think is crazy.
But, as the mother of a 13-year-old, I'm not so sure about that, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty convinced that it's not a good idea. But if California were willing to do so, it would be perfectly constitutionally valid.
And one more question for you, Carol, and then I do want to go to our listeners. As you mentioned, all those areas, Carol, where voting rights were expanded and then restricted and expanded again, I found it interesting looking at the timeline. As you said, in 1920, the 19th Amendment guarantees women's suffrage. 4 years later, Native Americans get the right. So they were kind of the last holdout there.
Even with the extension of suffrage to Native Americans, however, many states did not give Native Americans the right to vote. Native American disenfranchisement continued up until even I've seen a few cases in the 1950s, early 1950s, where states construed their rules not to include Native Americans. So there were it didn't simply end Native American disenfranchisement in 1924. Could I add one other thing, Laura?
Absolutely.
We've talked about ways in which states can restrict the franchise, but it is interesting and somewhat problematic today. The Voting Rights Act says the right to vote is a fundamental right. It is guaranteed by the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. Now, if voting is a fundamental right, people who study the court think that if in any case of a fundamental right, then government, and here we were talking about the states, should have to have a compelling state interest to infringe on it, to abridge it. And the state would have the burden of demonstrating that its restrictions were the least burdensome, that they were the narrowest drawn that they could possibly do to deal with this compelling state interest, and so on. But so that would make it seem as if burdening the right to vote ought to be difficult.
And the Voting Rights Act, that's that landmark piece of civil rights legislation from the mid-1960s, right, Carol? The Voting Rights Act. That's the biggie.
1965.
And the word compelling that you used is kind of open to interpretation, isn't it? Compelling state interest.
The court treats compelling state interest as demanding, as a very high bar. Anytime you say that the state has to meet a compelling state interest standard, you can almost take it to the bank that the regulation will fail. There are a handful, maybe two handfuls, of exceptions to that. But one would think that the state has a very high burden to demonstrate its need to restrict the right or to burden that right.
Real quick, too, Calvin, and then we'll go to our callers.
The problem with the compelling state interest standard is that the court has never given us clear guidance as to what's compelling.
Yeah, that's a very subjective issue.
So, and also, it's true. It's not just the Voting Rights Act. It's also the Supreme Court has said in the Harper case that voting is a fundamental right under the Equal Protection Clause, but that limits it to things that might constitute a violation of equal protection. And that's a whole another area. Equal protection, equal with respect to what?
Well, enough to keep lawyers and law professors
indeed.
Like both of you busy. I want to invite our listeners to join us as well. Our number here on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is great. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And Carol and Calvin, let's go to our callers. Alex been waiting in Derry. Hi, Alex. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the exchange.
Oh, thank you very much, Laura, for taking my call. Another excellent show.
Go ahead, Alex. Yeah.
I would like to propose a wide vision and look at voting in the context of when the Constitution was drafted. They fled a monarchy, and at the time the Constitution was drafted and was one of the main goals was a decentralized government.
Right, they were fearful of powerful central government, i.e. a king, right, Alex?
Exactly. And although I'm not qualified to comment on the right to vote, I think it's clear that the states should be in control of that. And I'd like to hear from your guests.
Yeah, thanks for the point, Alex. And Carol, I think I want to turn to you on this. What do you think? Alex is saying, let's leave it to the states.
Well, I think the right to vote is too important to simply leave it to the states. We've got plenty of evidence that states have historically made it very difficult for certain constituencies and certainly for African Americans to vote. However, having said that, there is really no I don't think I could make a strong case for federal control of state elections. One of the difficulties about talking about standardizing elections or more federal control of certain aspects of elections is that oftentimes on the ballot at any given election are both elections for president, member of Congress, maybe a senator, and also a lot of state races.
Sure, it's too inconvenient to do it on separate days. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, and so you could have a fairly complicated mess if the federal government required certain kinds of compliance for federal rules, and then the states could still do their own for state rules. So we're not trying to preempt state control over state elections, but I think that federal elections, as Calvin pointed out quite a while ago, that Article 1, Section 4, that says state legislatures can control the times, place, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives, but gives Congress the power at any time to make or alter such regulations, except as to the place of choosing senators. So Congress can weigh in on controlling federal procedures for federal elections, procedures for counting ballots, procedures for having voter registration rolls. And in recent years, they have done some of that.
Yeah, Calvin, what do you think? Thanks, Alex, for the call.
What Congress can't do is control state elections. It doesn't have any authority to do that. The only source of authority would be Section 5 of the 14th Amendment or Section 5 of the 15th Amendment. And the Supreme Court has sharply limited the ability of Congress to exercise that enforcement power. So I don't think Congress has any authority to regulate state elections. It can regulate federal elections if it wishes. And
should it? What do you think, given the concerns that Carol has raised?
No,
you know,
I don't think so.
The states sometimes don't have a great record on this.
Well,
in the past.
The Voting Rights Act and the decisions of the Supreme Court implementing the various constitutional amendments that have broadened the franchise, I think are adequate to deal with the with problems of discrimination in voting. I think what you'd have if Congress exercised fully its power to regulate federal elections and can't regulate state elections is you'd have the chaotic circumstance that Carol has described, in which you'd come to the polling place and there'd be one rule for voting for your federal representatives and another for state. You'd probably have to have two state ballots. If you think lines are long at voting places now, wait till that happens. So I think it's just impractical. But I also think that that's a great inhibitor for Congress to exercise as fully as it might its power to control federal elections.
Thanks for the call again, Alex. And let's go to Tom in Norwich, Vermont. Hi, Tom. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thanks. One of my favorite phrases from this current election that you hear a lot is the low-information voter. And it sort of begs the question, is there a voter who's so low information that it's actually irresponsible for them to vote or to allow them to vote? I like to bring this up when I want to shock my friends. My question is, how do people feel about a sort of current events quiz or civics quiz or just with really basic questions, you know, is Mitt Romney a Republican or a Democrat? You know, things like that would sort of filter out who could vote. I know that this is anathema to most people, but I'm just curious as to whether anyone's tried this or is it just too dangerous?
Well, it sounds like a literacy test, Tom, that they used to have to exclude certain groups, huh? What do you think?
Not really.
No?
Literacy is not that relevant to politics, but a political quiz is.
Okay. Tom, thanks a lot for calling in. It's an interesting point. Carol, what do you think?
Well, I think it would be viewed as a literacy test. Low-information voters certainly do trouble us, but there are many kinds of shorthand that people will use, such as party ID. Your caller does suggest that someone might not even know the party ID of the person running, but usually it's printed on the ballot. So just as there used to be stars and roosters and other kinds of things to help illiterate voters help figure out which party they were supposed to vote for, assuming that they can read, then they can see that, at least in my state, it is clearly indicated that Mitt Romney is running as the Republican candidate for president. I think that voters should be able to protect their own self-interest, but that doesn't mean they have to have a civics test to do so. And I do think it would be viewed as unconstitutional.
All right. Oh, did you want to jump in there real quick, Calvin?
Just quickly. I think that the idea of, well, first of all, low information voters are stupid voters. Let's not use euphemisms. But nonetheless, the threshold of stupidity that would be necessary to disqualify one from voting is so subjective that I believe that it would be plainly unconstitutional. I don't think there's any principled way in which one can do that. We can lament stupid voters, and I would certainly discourage stupid voters from going to the polls. So if you don't know who's a Republican or a Democrat in this election, please don't vote.
Well, Tom, thank you. You ignited an interesting conversation. I appreciate you calling in. Let's take another one before we go to a break. This is Michael in Portsmouth. Hi, Michael. You're on the air. Go ahead. Okay, I guess we lost out on Michael. I'll give out the phone number again. Maybe Michael will call us back. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Carol, I did want to return to something that we were kind of chewing on earlier, and this is the idea of whether leaving voting, at least the mechanics of voting, largely up to the states, is working out well. What do you think? Is it working? You both talked about the complexities of more federal control, and I appreciate that. But are there areas where you see more federal control, less state control as a good thing or not?
Well, let me point out first that we don't simply leave the mechanics of voting to the states anymore. The federal government has gotten increasingly involved. So we have both the 1993 bill called Motor Voter, the National Voting Rights Act, and we have the Help America Vote Act, which was passed in the aftermath of the 2000 elections. Both of those make some federal requirements for state management of elections. So, for example, we now have nationally a situation where if you go to renew a driver's license or get a driver's license, you will be asked if you want to register to vote. That's a provision of the Motor Voter Act. So the federal government made an effort to expand opportunities to register. In addition, the Help Motor Voter, the Help America Vote Act of 2002 provides federal funding for states to upgrade voting equipment. Now, if states accept that money, there are certain conditions on that acceptance. They have to get rid of the punch card and lever voting machines, for example, unless they adapt them somehow. They have to have voting equipment that is accessible to persons with disability and provisions to help people with limited English proficiency. In addition, states are required under Help America Vote Act to establish a computerized statewide voter registration list to allow faster, more reliable, and more centralized registration of voters.
And I got to cut you off, Carol, there. I do apologize. We will talk more after a short break and keep taking your calls, so stay with us.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Northeast Delta Dental, providing dental benefits to businesses of all sizes and individuals throughout New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont. Information at 800-537-1715. And the Wealth Management Group at Merrimack County Savings Bank, Trust and Wealth Management Services, provided by advisors committed to your financial needs. TheMerrimack.com. Good morning. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
Today on Word of Mouth, Jeffrey Toobin from Writers on a New England Stage. His new book follows the dueling visions of President Obama and Chief Justice John Roberts and allows us a peek on a court charged with interpreting contemporary culture through a constitutional lens.
What did James Madison think about video games? Did he enjoy them?
I'm Virginia Prescott. Jeffrey Toobin on POTUS v. SCOTUS and the unelected branch of government. Today at noon on Word of Mouth.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, reaction to today's election results nationally and statewide. You can email us your questions before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today, the Constitution and what our nation's founding document says and doesn't say about voting. Join our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. Do you see voting as a guaranteed right or is it a privilege? What discrepancies do you see in our founding document, our Constitution, about voting and elections? whether it's who can vote, the issue of how elections will be run, and the issue of electors, that electoral college that we're hearing so much about these days. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. And Carol Nakanoff, Calvin Massey, let's go right back to our listeners. Connor's calling us from Durham. Hi, Connor. You're on the Exchange.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
For me, this is a fundamental federalism issue. And looking back at the Constitution, really, the Constitution was a contract between the states and the national government. And it wasn't until the Bill of Rights that it became an issue with individual citizens. So I don't think it would have been realistic to have a right to vote in the Constitution.
Not realistic to have a right to vote in the Constitution, given the state control of the government, especially early on. Is that what you're saying, Connor?
Exactly. And to have it left up to the states was much more realistic.
Now, how about now, Connor? How do you feel about it, this system now? Does it still work well today, or have things changed?
Well, as your guests have noted, you know, there's been several federal actions that have impeded on the state's control of elections. Good, bad, or indifferent, it's a fact of reality in many parts of the government in terms of, you know, the national government stepping in. And some parts of voting, you know, need some uniformity across state lines. But majorly, I believe that it really should be left up to the states.
Okay, thanks a lot for calling, Connor. And Calvin, what do you think? It's still working pretty well.
I think so. I think that some of the things that Carol has mentioned have to do with the mechanics of voting and the ease of facilitating voter registration and the like. But I think by and large, it works fairly well. And I think that within the constitutional limits that have been imposed in terms of age, sex, and race and the like, the various constitutional amendments that have expanded the franchise, that states ought to be free to make their own individual decisions as to who should. And I mean, the issues are fairly narrow now. There's such things as felon disenfranchisement. You know, for example, a state could, if it wished, decide to permit non-citizens to vote. Now, I think that's a bad idea, but a state could decide to do that, and I don't see that there's any constitutional impediment to a state doing so. So it works both ways. Federalization of the franchise of determining who can vote could be a force for good or ill, depending upon your political perspective. It's like many federalism issues, that it depends on whose ox is getting gored. If you're a liberal and conservatives control the federal government, you want states to have more control. If you're a conservative and the liberals control the federal government, then you want states to have more control, and vice versa. So federalism is an issue of expediency. And I think that we have been served well over 200-plus years by allowing states to largely have control over the franchise, and I think that should continue.
And Carol, there's a group out there, I'm sure you're aware of them, called the Center for Voting and Democracy, which is pushing for a federal amendment to the U.S. Constitution, saying that there is a right-to-vote amendment needed at the federal level. They state a bunch of reasons why. They say millions of Americans are permanently barred from voting. They say state authority over voting creates unnecessary voting difficulties. They say that there are 50 sets of policies and procedures, and that gets confusing. They say that voters are intimidated or harassed. They say Congress is powerless to take action because there is no federal right to vote in the U.S. Constitution. What do you think? How well is this state-by-state system working?
Well, I don't think it works terribly well, Laura. One of the things that people who support such an amendment worry about, in addition to people getting turned away from the polling place, is the idea of wasted and spoiled ballots. There are many, many wasted and spoiled ballots in the United States, ballots that are cast and never counted. Some of that has to do with election machinery malfunction, especially with some of the older technology, but not exclusively. The rules for counting provisional ballots will vary state by state. The counting of absentee ballots and whether something is signed across the back. In some states, they want the if it's a ballot coming in from abroad, it has to be signed in particular places. So, and ballot design issues also end up disenfranchising some people. There are more than 50 sets of policies and procedures because an awful lot of county and level rules and procedures also affect elections. So I think that there is a reason to be concerned about trying to standardize some of the things that cause votes not to be counted or that bar students that bar people from voting. I mentioned students, but that's another one. I know that your law in New Hampshire is, I think, going to change next year again so that student IDs will no longer be acceptable and expired passports will no longer be acceptable identifications for voting. And yes, I would support a federal right to vote amendment. Jesse Jackson Jr. Introduced one into Congress after the 2000 election. So there are different texts floating around, but I think it would be a good idea.
And as we've been talking about the Constitution and what it says and how it's expanded, where in the Constitution, Carol, do you find sort of the basis for your feeling that way and also for the folks who are behind this Fair Vote movement? Where in the Constitution do you find the backup for that?
Well, you can find it. First of all, if we treat equal protection, if we believe with the Voting Rights Act that the right to vote is a fundamental right, then that right has been recognized now. But I think that many people actually thought that the 14th Amendment provided the place for that, where it says, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States.
So you're saying it's right there?
Well, the Privileges or Immunities Clause has not been read that way, but some people believe that it certainly should and does cover the right to vote. So I would think that an argument could be made that it's a 14th Amendment right of citizens of the United States.
What do you think, Calvin? And then back to our listeners.
There's two problems with the Privileges and Immunities Clause argument. First, as a matter of constitutional law, the court has pretty much eviscerated the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment. There's only one recent case in which and it doesn't have anything to do with voting, in which the court found a right that was grounded in that clause. And secondly, even if you did think that it had some substantive force, the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States in 1869, when the 14th Amendment was adopted, didn't include the right to vote. That was a state right. So even if you breathe new life into this moribund Privileges and Immunities Clause argument, it's not effective for that purpose. I think if these people who want to have a federal right to vote recognized, I think the avenue that they have to pursue is a constitutional amendment.
Amendment. There isn't. You don't think it exists then?
Well, I mean, there is a fundamental right to vote that is protected by the Equal Protection Clause, but the scope of that right is fairly narrow. It boils down to the question of that there has to be equality. It's such things as one person, one vote. But it's not so broad as to enable Congress to specify every conceivable detail as to who would be entitled to vote.
Let's take one more call if we could, or two more. Let's see Alan in Pelham. Go ahead, Alan. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Happy Election Day.
Thank you.
Earlier, I did hear one of your speakers talking about how that we shouldn't judge the constitutional authors in the light of the 21st century. And I just wanted to ask, it occurred to me while I was listening that the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, was written by people that were deeply mistrustful of the other states, and not 70 years later, the Civil War started. Now here we are 150 years after the Civil War is concluded, and I think that we're not quite so mistrustful of each other, and I'm wondering if perhaps the federal government couldn't streamline and perhaps shouldn't streamline some of these things. There probably would be some cost savings if they just set up some guidelines and establish a uniformity for elections. We're not deeply mistrustful of the other South as we were back in those days. I we can argue constitutional law and what they intended, but let's keep in mind that they weren't as friendly to each other. So I think that times have gone by, and I think the federal government could easily step in and just establish guidelines and save 50 sets of legislatures from wasting all that time debating these facts when I think the clock's turned.
Yeah, you're a good student of history, Alan, and you're right. He's right, Carol. They were deeply distrustful of each other. Your thoughts on that, Carol?
Well, I mean, Alan makes a good point. I think it's the question of trust does not solve the question of federalism, of course. If certain matters have been left in the hands of states, we have to make at least an argument for why the federal government has the capacity to intervene. But one could say that even drawing on the Equal Protection Clause, that each vote should be worth every other vote, and that each vote should be treated equally, which would allow for some kinds of legislation to achieve uniformity. Notice that certain provisions of the Help America Vote Act weren't rules so much as they were, if the state takes the money, then they need to do the following kinds of things. There were a few rules in Help America Vote Act, but that's one way the federal government has gotten states to do things they would like them to do, is by use of the carrot, in other words, the funding. And there's nothing to stop the federal government from doing that, except that we're not handing out checks right now, not a lot of them, in this economic climate. A colleague of mine pointed out that even though an awful lot of money was spent on new voting equipment around 2002, and following, some of that equipment is already obsolete, and some of it wasn't working well when it was chosen.
Wow. Well, Carol, I know you have to teach a class, so I'm going to let you go a little bit early. Thank you so much for being with us, and I hope you enjoy your trip to New Hampshire later on this month.
Well, thank you, Laura, and thank you, Calvin. It was my pleasure to be with you.
That's Carol Nakanoff, Richter Professor of Political Science, who teaches American Elections and Constitutional Law at Swarthmore College. Again, she'll be participating in the Constitutionally Speaking Symposium on November 17th. We'll put more information on that on our website, by the way, and on our Facebook page. And Calvin, a couple more thoughts from our listeners for you. We have an email from Wayne, kind of repeating what Tom, our caller, said earlier. I believe we as a nation are civically illiterate. So little time is spent on preparing citizens that they either do not vote or do not vote as informed citizens. So he's talking about what Tom said, that, you know, people are extremely uninformed, should they vote? But here's the other side of that from David. He says, to suggest that anyone not vote due to lack of knowledge is to suggest that a person's limited knowledge not count. Everyone's vote counts, says David, regardless of knowledge. Everyone's thought counts. So again, we discussed that earlier when Tom called, but I did want to acknowledge those emails that came through. And in one more question for you, we haven't touched on this yet, and yet it's been a huge theme linking our Constitution and our modern elections, and that's the Electoral College, Calvin. Boy, that's getting lots of attention this year. How did this whole system get started, and why do we stick with it today?
Well, it got started because it was it was another one of the compromises in 1787 to be sure that the small states, New Hampshire, Delaware, Wyoming, wasn't there in 1787, but that those small states would have a somewhat disproportionate ability to influence the selection of the president. So a deliberate choice was made to create the Electoral College to blunt the force of sheer population. That's, I still think, a reasonable compromise. But voting is not, in my opinion, is not just a matter of an aggregation of the preferences of every individual in the country. There are a lot of other factors that go into it. It seems to me that geography, the disparate position of various states is a reasonable thing to take into consideration, and that's a strong argument for maintaining the Electoral College. There will be elections, maybe this will be one, in which the winner of the popular vote is the loser in the electoral vote. And that will cause outcries for elimination of the Electoral College.
Just like it did in 2000.
Just like it did in 2000. 1876 is probably the most colorful example. I hope this election is not one of those. Those are my thoughts on the perpetuation of the Electoral College.
So you think the system is okay, even though it often does not reflect, quote unquote, the will of the people, people writ large, all Americans from, you know, from New Hampshire to Alaska to Hawaii?
Well, I think it works reasonably well. I think there's one reform about the Electoral College that I think might be reasonable, and that would be to assign electoral votes by congressional district. So that there are 435 congressional districts in America, and if each one of those districts had one electoral vote and then two electoral votes for the statewide vote for each of those states, that's a system that's adopted in Nebraska and in Maine. But those are the only two states that have that system. That would produce a result in the Electoral College that would be different than the winner-take-all by state system that we now have. It would be interesting to do a computation tomorrow to see what the electoral count would be if it was apportioned by each congressional district as opposed to what will actually happen.
Well,
I might make that calculation just for my own amusement.
Calvin, it's been really good to talk to you. Thank you very much. And as one of our callers said, happy Election Day. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That's Calvin Massey, Daniel Webster Distinguished Professor, who teaches constitutional law at the UNH School of Law. UNH Law is a partner in the project we talked earlier about, Constitutionally Speaking, which will be holding a symposium in Concord on November 17th. If you'd like more information on the project, we'll put a link up soon on our website and on our Facebook page so you can find out more there. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoi.